with the cross in towards Alfonso Davies. Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar. A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades finally arrives.
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Ben Steiner and Alexander Gonge-Rujic.
Hey there, folks, and welcome back into the Northern Football Podcast. It's episode 163 of Northern Football. Ben Steiner alongside Brendan Dunlop and Alex Gonge-Rujic. And we're in three different cities, two different countries right now. Brendan, you're in Toronto. Alex, you're in Vancouver, back from the U.S. And I'm in New York City after one of the worst travel experiences I've had in a while. But how are you guys doing?
Oh, man. Discount airlines? Weather? What happened to you?
Massive snowstorm in New York, and I've gone through the Canadian-U.S. border like six combined times in the last day or so. So my dad's currently stuck in Montreal, rerouted from Vancouver. His flight just got canceled, so it's been a minute for the Steiner boys here.
That's brutal. I mean, that's I guess why I'm lucky. I drove down to Spokane yesterday for a coolest experience I've been to in a while for a football related match. I've never been to Spokane, but geez, 6 hours of driving each way. But no, I got to tuck into my first U.S. Open Cup game, so I'm definitely probably a bit more of the enthusiastic traveler right now, even if I'm a bit tired after a long day on both sides.
How was that first U.S. Open Cup game for you?
Oh, it was great. I mean, the crowd was really good. 2,500 came out to for the game, which is impressive because the Spokane Chiefs were playing a playoff game at the exact same time across the street. So 2,500 soccer fans came out. Spokane scored an 85th minute winner. Luis Gil, former RSL guy, scored, and he did the sui in the corner, which is hilarious because he's 30. Like, I rate the energy, though. He pulled it off with good form. And yeah, it was just good vibes all around. The Spokane team is like brand new, so it's kind of interesting to talk to people there about what it meant and how cool it is to be part of it, especially because they're not dumb. They know what's going on with Open Cup, so it seemed to mean a little more yesterday.
I saw your pictures on Twitter and got real Swan Guard vibes. Having never been to Swan Guard, that was the vibes I got from the photos.
I'd say I'd implore CPL teams to copy it. It was a 5,000 seat stadium, brand new. It smells like fresh concrete, and you can see everything. I guess they built it for the USL League One team Spokane Velocity that it came in, and it is beautiful. There's a grandstand that looks at seats about 3,000. They've got about 1,500 on the other side, and then they've got some standing room behind both goals. It's a beautiful venue, and I'd encourage some CPL teams to maybe head down to Spokane and try to copy that stadium model, because it was really a great local feel about it.
I think they should also go about trying to copy some of the names that we see in USL League One and League Two, like the Spokane Velocity. How does that make its way? LA Force is also just, I don't know, it has something to it.
I saw LA Force. I saw like gear for it, and I thought it was like a police force or some, you know, type of like a paramedics team. I didn't think it was a real sports organization. Did you get gear, Alex? Is that what you're flashing off? What you're showing off?
I love it. Alex, nice. For those who can't see any of the video, Alex is showing off a Spokane Velocity kit, which is certainly exciting. We'll have more video for you guys coming soon as well. But let's get right into it. Big weekend for the Canadian Women's National Team coming up. They're taking on Brazil at the She Believes Cup, and then either the U.S. or Japan. And some changes to the Canadian Women's National Team roster as well. Emma Reagan and Mary Yasmin Aladu are in for Quinn and Olivia Smith. And that's a bit of a change for the national team, and Mary Yasmin Aladu gets her call up after everything that we spoke about last week.
Yeah, I mean, she's a player that has been in phenomenal form in Portugal, and we've debated, you know, where does the Portuguese league rank amongst the big leagues in Europe in women's soccer right now. But I looked at that immediately with Quinn's absence and thought, wow, like how happy is Desiree Scott to have an opportunity here? You know, going into this camp, which is a unique experience in general. Obviously, Bev Priestman has a lot of things to consider. And when she named Janine Becky and she named Desiree Scott, we all wondered, well, you know, how many minutes can she even allocate to either of them? And particularly Scott, who's really struggled, who made her return to NWSL at the weekend and I think played 65 seconds for the KC Current to wear the armband at the end. So when I saw that news, I felt for Olivia Smith and for Quinn, but I think both of those players are going to be on a plane to Paris, to be honest. And it gives other players and for my selfish interests and I'm just intrigued to see Desiree Scott in that squad now. So that's what stood out to me first, more so than Alidou getting called up, which we all expected. If there was an injury, she was the first phone call.
Yeah, I think it's mixed emotions for all four players, for good or bad. I think to start with Quinn, it's tough for them from a form perspective because they're probably right now arguably the most informed Canadian to start the year in the NWSL other than Janine Becky. Like, they were excellent the first few games for the Reign, the Seattle Reign, as I'll get used to saying again. They were just commanding performances, really made that number six position their own. And I was just really impressed. So it's a bit unfortunate from a form perspective because, yeah, like, let's be honest, Quinn is probably number named three or four or five on the roster when you're naming an Olympic team right now. Like, they're a lock. So that's not going to hurt their stock. Just you hope it doesn't disrupt their season, especially as a head injury. As for Olivia Smith, it is a bit tougher, I'd say, just because that forward line's so loaded that you really can't afford to step back, because who knows going to step up, right? Like, Clara Solarsi could pop off and have a big She Believes Cup. All of a sudden, it's a different discussion. You know, Evelyn Vien, you know, she's always good for a couple goals of her, especially she hasn't been scoring at Roma. I'm sure she'd love to get some goals for Canada in this window with an elevated opportunity. Mary Yasmin Alidou, I mean, we know what she's going to do. And speaking of, Alidou is a bit of a bittersweet one as well, because it's a second straight camp where she's been a last-minute injury call. You'd love to see her get it on merit. I mean, the numbers continue to speak for themselves. I think up to 25 goals, 3 assists now, which is a very good return at any league. But it continues to be the back door. I think Alidou, the vibe I'm kind of getting from Priestman is that it's just too late for her in this cycle. I think Priestman wants to consider her, but in a reality where you have 18 team rosters, unless someone is breaking down the door, which, to be fair, from my perspective, I feel like Alidou is very close, but from Priestman's perspective, she might not share that. It's something where she's kind of keeping her to the outside and maybe saving her for a longer look for after the Olympics when the World Cup 2027 prep starts. But hey, if Alidou can come in and do great, I mean, again, I think she's on the cusp of potentially at least making things interesting in that selection headache. Lastly, Emma Reagan, it'll be great to see her again, because I think she's someone that has upside long term, and that Canadian midfield remains thin. If there's an injury, I think Emma Reagan's a lot closer to sneaking her way in than we realize. And I think 2027 World Cup, that's someone where if she can continue to get minutes in Denmark and maybe move to a different league, she can very much sneak in and be part of that future in the midfield.
I do like the Emma Reagan shout. She impressed me a couple of years back when she was playing with Varsity FC in League One BC. And then, you know, she also impressed me in her two short stints with the women's national team back last year. But what should the expectations be for this tournament for Bev Priestman and the Canadian women's national team, Alex?
Yeah, so I think it's one where I'd like to see some winning habits, because this is a chance for them to really play top opposition. The Olympics is a gauntlet, right? I mean, it's pretty much the best of the best. Sometimes at the World Cup, of course, best on best, but you kind of get some lower teams. You get some teams that you're expected to beat. The Olympics is not like that. Everyone can beat the other, and you're going to need to get used to a dogfight. So I'm excited that there's three top 10 opponents in Brazil, Japan, the U.S. Take advantage of it, because Canada's record's mixed. They have the pre-September 2023 sample where they were struggling against top 10 teams. They got battered by a team like Australia, who was on the fringes. They lost to US, France, all these teams last year. But then they have the post-World Cup sample where they've changed a formation. They beat Brazil once. You know, they've given some good games. I want them to prove that this new formation can indeed work against top teams. I think it has. They've looked pretty good in most games as long as they've stuck with the 3-4-2-1. And we were robbed of them getting a chance to really show what they're about against the U.S. at the Gold Cup with the conditions. So I'd say take advantage of what it's going to be, no matter if you win the first one or not, two competitive top 10 games and try to win them while playing their way, the 3-4-2-1. And any auditions you can get out of that will be bonus. I think this is a chance. We've seen the players now audition themselves against at the Gold Cup where they're winning games 6-0, 5-0. That's great. But this will also be a chance for some of those players to step up and show that they can do it against top teams as well.
I think the performance expectation is to get the game that they should have had at the Gold Cup against the U.S. That I think they want that. I think they feel that they deserve to test themselves against the U.S. And hopefully that game could be just that. They beat Brazil and get that final in Columbus. From our selfish perspective, God, I would love to see that. I still feel like the football gods stuck it to us by giving us that horrible night in San Diego. So that's what I want. That's my expectation.
Is it a bad time to tell you that there was a tornado in Columbus the other day that postponed the crew game? Oh my God.
Somebody's flight get diverted or what?
So I just saw on Twitter there was the Champions Cup game got delayed an hour because of inclement weather.
What is going on? I thought the internet was fooling me. Did you see the tornado in Portugal? Like the water tornado over the bridge? I'm like, this is fake. And then I started seeing it on reputable sources. I'm like, oh my God, floods. Every Mets game got postponed and they still come back and lose. Was it the Mets you were supposed to see or the Yankees you were supposed to go see?
It's the Yankees I was supposed to go see. I'm supposed to go see them tomorrow too.
Well, hopefully it doesn't rain.
Against the Blue Jays, if it doesn't rain. So
there you go. Fittingly timed.
Yeah. I mean, and the Blue Jays have gotten off to a kind of terrible start. Your Tigers have gotten off to a good start. But
how hyped up do you want to get me right now? How hyped up do you want to get me?
They just lost. We're recording at just after 6:30 on Thursday, and the Tigers just got their first loss of the season. But 5-1 and the home opener is pretty
good. Only disappointment is that I didn't throw a little money on that, because after they won the first game of the doubleheader and there was no turnaround, they just boomed straight into the next one. I'm like, they're going to lose the second one. There's no way they're going to start 6-0. How many games can the Mets lose? They'll lose a lot, but come on. It's not going to go down that way.
We won't dive too much into Major League Baseball, but look,
you've already lost John Molinaro, just so you know. Molinaro's listening, boom, out. He hates baseball talk.
Diving into the She Believes Cup a little bit more, what should Bev Priestman look for in this tournament, Alex?
I think kind of an extension of what I mentioned earlier. Really see how these players react to this top games, right? Top test teams that you should be beating at the Olympics. This is really... I'm thinking of someone like Adriana Leon, who had an excellent Gold Cup, and she's been a continued driver. So it's, you know, something where she's already shown she can do it in these sorts of games. Keep that up, right? See what if Asimi Awuju, you throw her in, what can she do? She was excellent at the Gold Cup, and I think would have really shined in that U.S. game had it not been an absolute flooded mess. You know, Jade Rose, continue to see what she can bring. I mean, she seems like a lock to go to Paris at this point. We'd like to continue to give her some more top-tier tests. I think really test some of those players beyond the big seven, big eight players on this roster. And yeah, I think just tactically, I want to see what this 3-4-2-1 can do against top-level opposition. And I'd like to see Bev Priestman stay. If I were going to maybe amend anything tactically, I'd love to see what their secondary plan could be other than the 4-4-2, because I think we've seen them, from what it seems like now, when the 3-4-2-1, they're not liking it. They go to a 4-4-2 and the results have not been very good. I'd love to see them continue to develop maybe a different tactical plan as a backup, maybe a 4-3-3, because they've got a lot of wingers on the roster, something like that. But that would, you know, be nitpicking, because I think I'd love to see 180 minutes of raw sample size of that 3-4-2-1 against in these two games and really determine if it's the right formation going forward. I think it is, but I think this tournament, you could really cement that and prove that you've got your setup now to go into the Olympics. You just got to figure out which 18 players fit that setup best.
I think there's a handful of players she's not even paying attention to. Like you mentioned a core eight, you know, barring something catastrophic. Like this tournament is not about watching Jesse Fleming and Kadisha Buchanan and Ashley Lawrence. She's not even paying attention to Adriana Leon, with the exception of maybe how she might work in some different format that she's tinkering with. Someone like Jordan Huytema, I think, is going to have far more of her attention. I think that they're going to try to aerially use her more. That we saw in the Gold Cup, like how poor they were with set pieces kind of overall. It didn't seem like they were firing on all cylinders from the set piece department, so they're going to work on that certainly. Someone like Shalina Zdorsky, Bev's looking at, like, do I need you on this plane? Yes, I would like you, but I only have 18 seats. Do I need you on this plane? Simi Wujo, I think, is someone who's like really on the cusp. I think she wants to see, yeah, can she elevate her game and take it to another level after such an amazing Gold Cup? Obviously, there's a lot of momentum that she's got right now in her game. I think she's very, very well liked in the team from all accounts. It seems like the chemistry seems really good. Like, I know we say that all the time, and hey, it's for the cameras. When the cameras are on, everybody's a little bit different, including us. But it does seem like, to use your Gen Z term, the vibes are nice, guys. The vibes are magnificent in the Canadian women's camp based on the stuff they're putting out. So it feels like it should be pretty good on Saturday.
And it's certainly been a refreshing breath of fresh air for Canada Soccer over the last little while, both with the stuff they're putting out in terms of the training uncut and the new YouTube series as well. But Kevin Blue also releasing a bit of a less exciting update about Canada Soccer and the financial happenings or lack of happenings within Canada Soccer at the moment. But Brendan, just your initial takeaways from the Kevin Blue announcement, which I thought was positive to see that transparency. Transparency can also be a cover for other things that are going on within the organization. And I think we saw a little bit of what the problems are. But transparency, while it's great, it doesn't solve those issues.
Ooh, the suspicion that comes through there, Steiner, the suspicion through it all. You started this off by saying less than exciting. Just the fact that he's speaking at all is pretty exciting. The fact that it came on a Saturday, I found somewhat surprising, but also somewhat in line with how Canada Soccer does things. It would have been weirder if it was Friday at 7:30 p.m. and it was like, oh yeah, by the way, this is the deficit this quarter, and well, we're working on it, don't worry. The fact that it didn't quite include that, it wasn't as dire, I thought, is pretty good. I mean, you're right, you know, being over transparent, there is a side to that potentially as well. But as we've said before, and talking about the experience this guy has, like, I really like that he's laid it all out there. I think it's he's really laid it out for himself in ways that other people in that position either weren't capable of doing or were unable to do. And it's obviously a huge task ahead, but he's really spoken about, you know, looking at this with the opportunity here to be Canada Soccer themselves, be able to bring in money. And I think he's the person that can do that. So it's been hard for many people over the last three decades to find some money in soccer. But there's a lot of corporate money that floats around with sports, and you finally have someone that I can find creative and new ways to do that. So it's got to kind of get through this cycle. The fact that they're not going to go bankrupt because they go on a run at Copa America is a pretty positive feeling, I think, for Canadian fans that may have been a little worried seeing some of those comments last year. And not just fans. I mean, there's a lot of people in the game that thought they had a good idea of where things were, where Canada Soccer was. And then when Jason DeVos made those comments, I thought, oh, maybe I don't know. Maybe I'm not as connected as I thought before. And these are, you know, a lot, I'm speaking of alumni and people that have worked with the organization before. So Kevin Blue obviously has a lot of work in his hands, but the teams keep performing on the pitch, as we've seen. That's definitely going to help him have some better conversations off the pitch.
Yeah, I like just how he's shooting it straight, right? Like, he's just putting it out there, for better, for worse. Even in his press conference, we've seen in his releases, if he knows something, he puts it out. He says he knows. If he doesn't know something, he puts his hand up, like, I'm willing to learn. I want to surround myself with the right people. You know, he's putting out straightforward information. He's putting it in context too. That's what I really liked about Canada Soccer's losing this much money. For context, some other nations similar to us, like, you know, United States, right, south of the border, and Australia, you know, a big economy country that just hosted a World Cup, something that Canada might aspire to get to. Like, you put out a bunch of relevant figures, you know, just mentioned, like, look, this is the situation. We have a deficit. It's not a deficit that we're very comfortable about. It's not a deficit we want to keep up. Because, you know, sometimes in business, sometimes you run a deficit with the long-term goal of running, you know, a surplus. In this case, it's like, no, this isn't a good deficit. This is something we don't want. And now we're going to look to fix. And I like that it's just clear, as clear as he can be. Because, you know, again, like something like the bankruptcy, you know, gate, if you want to call it, last year, it's something where, look, it's not... Jason DeVos didn't say anything that was out of line, right? He's like, look, we're looking at what bankruptcy means, but just saying something like that can get taken so out of order, so misinterpreted. It's something, oh, they're broke, they're looking at bankruptcy, when he had to walk it back. But like, look, we looked at what that would entail for us if we were. Whereas, you know, a lot of what we're seeing from Kevin Blue is shooting it straight, no need to walk it back. He's admitting this is where we are, this is where we want to be. And now I'm very curious to see where he takes it forward, because obviously the big thing is, you know, in the piece he mentioned that, you know, a membership increase will be one of the big ways of fixing that revenue gap. And, you know, they're mentioning that a lot of the member fees haven't changed since 2017, you know, despite inflation and all those other factors that would usually make it raise. But as we know, I think in the past, member prices being raised hasn't always gone over well. So I'm going to be curious to see how that's received, because obviously that's a big pool of cash, and it could be a touchy subject to be leaning on your members to gain cash as a federation. But that's also a reality of a lot of, you know, at least some federations worldwide end up leaning on their members. And that could potentially be a way to start before you start really ranking in some of the other sponsors, some of the other philanthropic avenues to be raised. So it'll be interesting to see how that actual plan lays out, but it is interesting to see what the plan is, right?
Revenue from members' fees is definitely one way. The problem for Canada Soccer was, for so long, it was like the only way, and it was relied upon. So you're right about, you know, turn to this first, like as the Kickstarter, it's the easy one. I would hate to see this become, you know, considered the major driver again, as it was in years past. I think we're past that as a federation. I think soccer in general has elevated so much that it's impossible to run a competitive program if that's your number one financial backing. And with Blue, as he's spoken, it's not going to be. It can't be. What I liked about that release, and I think for the public, so the explanation that we haven't had before, I think a lot of people think that there's a lot more money. I think people involved in the sport might be surprised at how big their operating, you know, budget and how big their operating costs were last year, with 28 or 30 million last year. That feels like a lot for, you know, an organization like Canada, who you think don't play a lot of home games, and then therefore they don't have a lot of opportunity to incur that revenue, that gate revenue from hosting home games. This has been a problem for Canada for years, and particularly with, you know, 3 years of the pandemic where they haven't been able to incur and build that gate revenue. Like, that's a huge, huge setback for this program. I also like the number that, and using the U.S. as a comparison, because I think a lot of people like to do this, don't realize what a different stratosphere it is. They had an operating budget of 187 million last year and ran a surplus of 3 million, not 30 million, not 300 million. They only ran a surplus of 3 on an operation of 187 million. And we're talking about Canada at 30 million. Like, I think in a lot of ways we need to keep that in perspective. People can lose that perspective because they think, oh, Alphonso Davies in the Champions League, Jonathan David in the Champions League, look at these players we've got in tier one situations now, we've made the World Cup, we're playing against Messi in Argentina. But the gap just between the U.S. and Canada is still massive.
Yeah, it's two different stratospheres in terms of two organizations, because, you know, you can just look at everything about the United States and it's bigger. There's more money flying around. There's a better structure between the funding side of U.S. soccer, which is no longer tied with Soccer United Marketing, which is no longer tied in the same way as it used to with MLS. And Canada is in the very sort of early stages of that with the CPL, CSB, Canada Soccer. Whereas in the U.S., they went through a lot of the similar stuff, but are, you know, 25 years down the line in a much bigger marketplace with much bigger money. And they're seeing the benefits of that now in terms of the money that they're able to spend on these national team programs. And I checked out, you know, the MLS offices today, and I've been to the CPL offices in Toronto, and it's clear that one of these leagues has been around for, you know, three decades longer, and Canada will get there. I don't think it gets to the size of MLS. I don't think Canada Soccer gets to the size of U.S. soccer, but Canada will get there eventually in terms of having enough to spend on national team programs, being able to fund the youth programs and everything that comes along with being a national federation. But because the soccer landscape is still so young in this country, it makes it really tough. And the transparency is good. It's giving us a look inside about sort of the struggles of Canada Soccer, but there's still no clear pathway, right? Like the membership increase, okay, you know, that's going to help. It's going to irk a lot of people who are members of Canada Soccer because, you know, increasing costs in any way right now is not going to go over well. We see that in government taxes with, you know, the new carbon tax introduced and raised, that raising Canada Soccer registration fees is not going to necessarily help. But it's a way this program can start to make a little bit more money and start to adjust under this CSB deal as well.
And it's important to mention, right, reading through the release again, he mentioned at the end that, look, you know, I understand that there's a lot more to be at stake. And he said, he's having meetings with the, you know, the relative stakeholders in the CSB and the national teams in the coming weeks, which is going to be key to kind of getting an alignment there. Cause I, you know, that'll be huge from the financial situation. Cause, you know, it feels like over the last few years, there's been a lot of ropes being pulled in different directions. You know, what do the men's national team players want? What do the women's national team players want? What's the, you know, what's coming in from CSB? What's the revenues, you know, yada, yada, yada. I think, you know, an alignment across the board, which is what Blue mentioned of, will also help clear things up. Cause yeah, I mean, look, Canada might not be a US, at least if they ever end up being that at that level of financial, you know, status of a US that's just a global superpower economically, it's going to be a long time down the road. But why not Australia, right? You look at some of the numbers that it says they ran $112 million of expenses. Of course, it's a World Cup year, but if a country like Australia, you know, a lot, pretty big country in size, but not a huge country in terms of, you know, it's not as big as the US in a lot of these ways. It shows that there's a road for there, because Australia's been in a similar boat where their domestic leagues, men's and women's, have, you know, they're not that ancient either. This is something they've been working on in a while, and they really felt the impact of what they did last summer with the Matildas, and now they're selling out stadiums and there's a lot of interest in their domestic league. I think Canada can at least look at an Australia as a potential avenue for what a post 2026 future could look like, if between now and then they align things in the proper way.
And also some exciting news on the professional side of the game in Canada. Project 8 announcing that 6 clubs have applied for professional club licensing. And certainly a big deal there as they start to take more strides towards a 2025 kickoff. Of course, the Vancouver Whitecaps, Calgary Foothills, and AFC Toronto already within the league as confirmed clubs. Halifax, a rumored club, but then 6 clubs applying for this, and we're not sure about the remaining clubs in that. And it could also be, you know, more than 6 by the time that they actually come to kickoff.
I would love to see 8, as which was the intention and what they hoped. But the fact that they've registered for 6, you know, with an annual general meeting coming in May, and there'll be more information, and we should find out the other 2 remaining clubs and have confirmation on what the Atlantic Halifax club will actually look like and perhaps be called. You guys were talking about team names before. I've seen on the business registration guide that there's a Halifax name that's not Atlantic Women's FC. It sounds very similar to Velocity. So I don't want to give it too much credence, as it's not officially confirmed. I never trust those things. When you see those business registration things, then they ask you to pay for it. Like, I don't know about that. Anyway, sidetracked. The fact that there's 6 confirmed teams, or at least 6 teams that registered, you know, means that they're continuing to put the bricks down to build this league to play next year, which is super exciting. I can't believe how much time has gone by. It's obviously a massive undertaking by Diana Matheson and her team, and all signs seem to indicate that one of those remaining 2 teams must be in Quebec. We know that that's was a huge priority for Diana Matheson. So I'm excited to see, you know, where those 2 are, and if there is in fact one in Quebec, because I think the CPL is really missing out by not having one there themselves.
Yeah, imagine a world where you get a Project 8 team in Quebec and then a CPL team in Quebec around the same time. What a boost that would be for the game in the country. Because of course, there's been, you know, strong CPL Quebec rumblings since Mark Noonan came in in 2022. So what a world that would be. But yeah, no, for Project 8, it's a good step, right? You know, you need sanctioning as a league, and we'll get an idea of what these inaugural clubs will look like, what a schedule could look like. Very curious to know how they run it with 6 teams. Like, you know, do you do a 4 match rounds and go for a 20 game season and playoffs to keep it, you know, straightforward in the first year, get it off the ground? You know, what are the final teams going to look like? What's ticketing going to look like? I'm especially curious for the Whitecaps too, for example. Like, what's their, you know, plan for this? Is this going to be a team that plays out of Swongard, at Thunderbird, BC Place? How much of the initial Whitecaps team is going to be, is it going to be all their youth players? Are they going to bring in a couple older players to supplement it? I mean, those are all questions we'll get into down the road. But no, I think the licensing step's definitely huge, because it's quietly snuck up on us, right? I think in an ideal world, they're probably launching around mid-April, May, like kind of the CPL is doing. That's 12 months away. So the fact that the steps have been put in to start licensing is exciting, because It's, you'd assume that that goes through. Of course, Canada Soccer retweeted and reposted the exciting Project 8 announcement today. And then once that's done, it's really going to be an exciting sprint of signings and everything, which is going to be quite a reality to imagine.
And we got a question from W Soccer CA on that as well. For Project 8, pick one marquee or DP signing that you'd like to see for each club, assuming that these clubs, you know, the initial announcement said that each club would have a national team player on it. And whether that's still within the possibility, who knows? But if you were to pick one, let's say Canadian marquee player for each of the clubs that we already know. So let's go with the four-ish clubs that we already know. Who would they be?
Oof. I mean, does retired internationals count? Because I think this is a really good chance that you got Sophie Schmidt playing in the league. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're, if there's at least an appearance by Christine Sinclair. And I think Vancouver would be the spot, obviously, right? So I feel like one of those two is probably guaranteed. And the second one, I think, would have a lot of people excited and certainly get a lot of attention.
I think there's certainly phone calls that have been made to Christine Sinclair or have been planned, at least, because, you know, she's so attached to Portland. That's her home now. But there's got to be some sort of possibility to explore playing at least a few games for the Whitecaps or potentially retiring in that kit.
So it must be fascinating, the text she has with Steph Labbe. Of course, you know, is a big part of the women's program now with the Whitecaps and building that up. And the text with Diana Matheson, who, of course, Sinclair was, you know, standing alongside when the Project 8 announcements first came out. And God, was it now 22? It's the time flies. Already almost been 2 years since that announcement. So imagine there's a lot of text there. I think, yeah, a lot of the intrigue is on a Vancouver team, just, you know, that Whitecaps pull behind it and the team they've got built and Labbe, you know, helming the operations. Like, I think the easy ones are Sinclair, Schmidt, but, you know, I doubt a Grosso goes or could a Hoytema, you know, is that something, you know, really could set the tone of year one of the league. I don't think Hoytema goes personally, but could they make the call? That's definitely would be a DP level signing to bring someone like her home. So that's kind of the big one, because Calgary definitely has a lot of pull too. So I think they could probably sneak, you know, some of the various Alberta talent across the board. I think Toronto as well is going to have a huge pull. Like, imagine if they say they get, I don't know, maybe Kadisha Buchanan has decided she's wanted it all and enough in Europe. You know, she's a Toronto native. She comes home and is a rock at the back line for AFC Toronto. That would be a huge signing. So I think that definitely the Whitecaps and Toronto ones feel like the teams to watch in that regard.
I think it's going to be, especially in year one, right? It's going to be very similar to when the Canadian Premier League launched. And, you know, we wondered, like, who would the names be? Will there be any players that you know? And there was a few players with Canadian men's national team experience and that I think surprised a few people. So you should get some of those players, but I think, you know, Hoytema, it would be hard to picture Hoytema doing that now at this point in her career. Certainly Grosso, you know, you think of some of these players who are coming out of college or maybe would consider leaving college early. Like, is it worth it to do 1 year in Canada, the first year of the league, especially? Like, these are all conversations that they'll weigh, but I'm interested to see, you know, how many players that we're quite familiar with might be out there. Because, as I say, that first season in the CPL, right, the Nick Ledgerwood, Marcus Haber might not have been the first season, but he was there at the Island Games for sure. Fraser Aird, you know, has got 8 caps with the national team, I think, and he was in there. So I think that there might be a few names that we recognize, but I don't really see there being current national team players. Not ones that have an opportunity to, you know, compete at major tournaments for Canada still.
It's going to be interesting where that line is though. Cause I think CPL, you're going to be surprised if, you know, anyone close to the national team in the first year made the jump, just cause, you know, you're a brand new, you know, men's league in an ecosystem where some of the stuff is so built up, but, you know, on the women's side with so many of these leagues still being new, right? You're talking about, some NWSL, for example. In my head, it feels like it's so established because I've grown up with it. It's, you know, barely a decade old. Where is this, you know, Canadian league going to fall into that? It feels like it's going to be already a lot closer to the top. So I wonder where that line is. Like, for example, okay, maybe not Hoytema. She's a starter on an NWSL team. But what about some players who aren't starters on an NWSL team, right? Like, what about, say, a Victoria Pickett, who's kind of been you know, she started last game for the North Carolina Courage, but start the year she hasn't, you know, been a starter. Same Megan Reed, who's a backup center back. And, you know, of course, now knows she's Canadian as a dual national. She's hasn't started yet for an Angel City. Would that be someone you consider? Because I'd still think that's a pretty good coup. That's someone who's, those are players who have been in national team camps, you know, are still on NWSL rosters. I wonder if that's something where they start there and then you go and, because yeah, I don't think it's something where you're unlikely to touch, you know, your Grossos, your Beckys, your Gilles, for example. But where does that line fall for some of those players who are either on the fringes of NWSL and European rosters, or of course, veterans?
I mentioned the college route, which obviously has been very beneficial for a lot of women's players over the decades. It's changed how valuable NCAA is, but I'm thinking about someone like Annabelle Chukwu, who's what, going to be still 18 when the league kicks off? Like, is that someone that goes down that route as opposed to going to college, as we've seen players in the past do?
I think she shall consider it. I think what we're seeing is now there's more and more benefit, right? We've seen it in the last year. Amanda Allen skipped college altogether to go pro in Orlando. Mm-hmm. I wonder if in her scenario, she was 17 at the time, if she would have chosen a Canadian league. Did it with Olivia Smith, who just did a year of college. She's like, all right, enough. I'm going to go pro at 18, and she's killed it. I think what we're seeing in Europe is there's a clear emphasis on European players going pro early. I think the U.S. has realized that they've got a bunch of 15, 16, 17-year-olds in the NWSL now. Like, they've had Olivia Moultrie, Alex Pfeiffer, I think Barcenas, I think her name was, at San Diego, was really great at the U-17s. I wouldn't be surprised if one of the Chukwus, for example, made that jump up, or, of course, some of the ones at the Whitecaps, like Geneva Hernandez-Gray. I think she's still only 17. She's already been in a Canadian camp. You have to imagine she goes pro, because I think what we're seeing as well is that college route just isn't as considered as much. If you're a top prospect, there's a lot of value to the college route. There will always be a lot of value to the college route. We see it on the men's side with the men's national team, but I think it's kind of trending to a similar place on the women's side, where it's like, it's a late bloomer. You can go there and still have a career. There's nothing wrong with making your pro debut at 23, 24, still have plenty of time, but there's a lot of benefit. If you're a top player at 18, go pro. And I think we might see some of the Canadian youngsters kick. I would 100% like, maybe one of the Chukwus end up on a Toronto team, or if there's an Ottawa team, because they're from there, that one would write itself in pen.
I don't see there being a Winnipeg team in the final couple teams to be announced, but could Desiree Scott find her way into this league with coming back from injury, but maybe that age where, you know, it's the twilight of her career, for better or for worse, and maybe she is able to see out her career in Canada, potentially with a team like Calgary that's a little bit closer to home.
100% Calgary, yeah, 100%. That was someone I was thinking of when we were talking about, you know, national team players. And I think, to be honest, you know, that she's someone that's probably going to be the club opportunity for her over the next couple of years. Hopefully she can play professionally a couple more years. So I think that's she's definitely picking up the phone and having long conversations. And, you know, Calgary's the prairies. People forget. That'd be a pretty good fit for a very, you know, proud Winnipegger like Desi Scott.
Let's round it off with names. So we gave what? We gave Schmidt to Vancouver, Toronto. I mean, I don't know if we actually finalized the pick, but if we give Scott to Calgary, let's give Toronto someone. I like the Kadisha Buchanan shout, but way too early. I'm going to go Alicia Chapman from Oshawa.
Ooh.
You know, maybe after she has she obviously had her kid, she returns. Maybe she goes close to home and then goes and becomes a fan favorite in Toronto with her hard tackling ways. So that just leaves someone for Halifax. We'll have to figure out who the fourth one is.
That's a good shout, Lisa Chapman. I like that.
I certainly like that as well. But we'll jump into some MLS chat as well. Whitecaps take down Portland. Ryan Raposo saving the day after the Whitecaps went up 2-0 and then blew the lead against Portland/Canada. And then TFC got completely outplayed against Sporting Kansas City in what was one of the worst performances of the season so far for TFC, probably the worst performance under John Herdman in his era. And it just looked like they just failed to shut down the midfield. SKC just said long shots and prayers and managed to beat Luka Gavran on multiple occasions from well outside the box. That it's a reassess point for TFC, but there were a lot of positive points, I thought, as well, for TFC and the Whitecaps in their results, despite TFC's end result.
More positives for the Whitecaps, I think. I watched that game. I know, Alex, you were at that game in Vancouver, but I was there in Toronto. I went to training on Friday for the first time this season, so I feel like bad luck, Brendan. The next time I see Herdman, he's going to be like, get out of here. You showed up for the first time, and you came to the game, and we sucked. But they did. Like, they really looked broken. Kansas City just opened them up. And Luka Gavran made some world-class saves in the first half. He made 7 saves overall. I think 4 or 5 he had in the first half alone. And, like, jaw-droppers. There was 3 jaw-dropping saves that he'd made. And he'd said post-game, he's like, look, we know that they're going to shoot from well out. They love to take these long-range shots. And that's exactly what ended up beating him in the second half. You definitely felt like the momentum. TFC was incapable of shifting the momentum, and that was just building. And a Kansas City goal was going to come sooner rather than later. And, you know, 3-1 with a Jonathan Osorio stoppage time goal flatters TFC a little bit, because they were not, you know, only 2 goals worse off than Kansas City. The possession was very much in TFC's favor, but they were dominated and ran into a wall in every facet in that game. It was not a good performance by TFC at all.
Well, I'll split my thoughts into 2. I'll start with TFC, then we can throw it back around for the Whitecaps. I understand putting them together because, hey, they play each other this weekend, so it's easy to splice it together. But no, for TFC to start, I think what we're kind of seeing as well is, you know, how perfect everything has to be defensively to get wins. And that's not a bad thing, right? Like, they've mostly shown that despite all the injuries, despite all the absences, they can be organized, they can be compact. They can get results, but in a game like this, it shows that on games where it's just not going your way, you're going to need some juice in that in the offense, and especially with Lorenzo and Insigne out long term, there are big question marks of who carries that load. Can it be Federico Bernardeschi? You know, it feels like there's a big question mark on that right now, because, you know, for as committed as he's been when he's been slotting in at wing back, we haven't really seen him have those takeover game moments like Lorenzo and Insigne has had, despite his very limited availability, at least in terms of his physical outputs. So for the defense, look, it was, you know, there weren't any egregious structure mistakes. In the first half, it was probably a lot more stretched than Herdman would have liked. It just felt like that game was wide open. And you look, and there was constant 3v2s, 4v3s, which is not what you want. And that's not what TFC has been about. They got away with it because Luka Gavran liked those in-close shots, but it felt like eventually they were going to break. And yeah, it's tough that it comes from long shots, but eventually you give up enough chances, you put enough pressure on your keeper, it's tough to ask him to be perfect all game long. So I think for them, they'll look to, especially against a Whitecaps team, that if Fafa Pico is starting, they will not want the game to open up because he's been lethal to start the year. They're going to have to shut that down. And on the other side, yeah, I'm genuinely curious to know where the offense is going to come from. Is it going to be enough between Bernardeschi and Osorio? Are they going to need a bit more juice? Is it going to be something as, you know, is DeAndre Kerr going to be, you know, the solution? Is Tyrese Spicer going to be the solution? You know, there's been some pushes from TFC faithful that maybe he could go higher up the pitch, which isn't a bad idea. He's been very attack-minded as a wingback. Jaquiel Marshall-Rudy's been also someone who's had a quietly good start. He got an assist in the cause. Maybe you move him higher up the pitch because he's obviously naturally a winger. There are questions to be had, but look, well, that'll be the big question mark when Insigne returns. If they're still in a good position as they are, it will be because they've had guys step up. But if not, if they fall down the table, it just shows how reliant the offense has been on Insigne.
It's a quick take on Tyrese Spicer. I know that he took a lot of flack for his I can be maybe like a Alfonso Davies type when he got drafted. 100% John Herdman told him that, and you can see exactly why he told him that, because he does have a lot of those qualities that remind you of Alfonso Davies. And, you know, his athletic ability allows him to correct on the fly mistakes that he's making, be from inexperience or just being in the wrong position, where he can make up for it very, very quickly, because he is so damn quick. He is a very exciting piece to watch. And as a wingback role, I think he ticks a lot of boxes for TFC right now. That's someone that I think is really going to, you know, keep hold of his place or has a real opportunity to put his stamp on this team right now. And going up against Vancouver is going to be a really good test. Like, you're going to see a lot of these players on turf, you know, for some for the first time this season, him being one of them. I don't think he got much action in New England. They always play a little different when that happens. it'll be interesting. Shutting down Fafa Picot is something that they probably weren't scouting for before, but man, he's been amazing for the Caps to start this year. I did not think they would rely that much on him to start, but he's been a real gem.
It's not great to be relying on such a MLS journeyman veteran to drive your attack, but the Whitecaps have been doing that, and they've been doing that fairly well. I do think that they probably need, you know, one or two more pieces to really enter that next echelon of MLS, but they're a solid team right now, and they're putting up the results to show it, even though there were some moments against Portland, you know, the fall apart to let a 2-0 lead slip that they certainly can learn from. But when you look at the matchups, especially with Tyrese Spicer, I'm going to be intrigued how he goes up against Alessandro Schupp, who's been playing in that wide role and doesn't have much pace to him, but was in a bit of a like dynamic partnership with Fafa Picot, because Schupp would shift in, Picot would shift out, and then they'd completely catch their defender out, and then they'd switch, and you're dealing with an entirely different dynamic. And they're both on that right side, but offering completely different profiles. And they were consistently switching against Portland. And I think that's something that will provide an intriguing matchup, especially if Spicer's on that side against a slower Alessandro Schupp.
Yeah, it's a big matchup, because the Whitecaps, defensively, their structure has been very good. Yes, they've allowed some very weird goals, but you know, the numbers show they're not allowing a lot of high danger chances. For the most part, you watch the breakdowns back, they're just individual, you know, they play a very rigid zone system. Someone steps 3 feet outside their zone, tracks their man, classic stuff. It can break down. But the pros of it is that they've done very good in eliminating space and wide areas. Just, it boggles the mind because, yes, playing Alessandro Schupp at wingback when he's struggling to keep up with the speed of the game in midfield defies expectation. But with the 3-4-3, the Whitecaps do a good job of keeping space between the lines. So, yeah, I'm very curious to see how Spicer does. And especially in the buildup, can TFC find him? Because I think if Spicer can get in behind Schupp, absolutely it can cause problems. But for the most part, the Whitecaps have a dynamic enough rotation where they also got Matias Laborda, who plays really aggressive right behind that right wing back, which covers up, you know, if there's ever some spaces that get opened up. And, you know, a big part of the Whitecaps press is that they want teams to build up from goalkeeper, center back, straight to wing to fullback, where I think the key is that you have to go in the middle, but then if you go in the middle, you go through Kuba. So that's kind of their trap that they're trying to set. If TFC can find a way to get that ball to Spicer in behind, there'll be potential, but the Whitecaps have shown well enough in that regard. So it's going to be interesting to see how that TFC attack lines up, because I mentioned them not having enough juice. This Whitecaps team is going to be a very good test, because there are some breakdowns in them. I mean, just look at the Portland goals this weekend. The two they allowed from the Whitecaps, they were errors that I'm sure, had Vanni Sartini pulling his hair out, at least the first one, the way that Tristan Blackman just tracked his runner and left this huge gap for Evander to put the ball in. But I think for TFC, getting that space in behind the wingbacks and, you know, maybe a bit of movement in the back to kind of disrupt that zone will be their keys to try and break down this solid Whitecaps team.
And Brendan, I know you've been high on CF Montreal. They're up against a struggling Seattle Sounders side this weekend. What do you see in their matchup?
Yeah, they've been an exciting team, man. I really like what Laurent Courtois has got going on. I think that they're still kind of finding their feet in some ways. But to go up against Seattle usually is never easy. The West Coast trips always seem to be kind of tough for Montreal to begin with. But I really like the fact that they're still figuring out what they have in Joseph Martinez. And if he can stay healthy, like, he can be a lethal super sub, as we've seen to start the year. But he also can be such a key piece from the start. So if they can go and punch Seattle in the mouth to start, that would be a fantastic way to begin for them. But yeah, Montreal's been an exciting team to watch. And so now you got the flip side. You guys can not stay up late, I guess, but depending on what part of North America you happen to be in at the weekend, Ben, a 10:30 Montreal game and a 7:30 Eastern Vancouver game will be quite the difference this Saturday night.
I'm actually really disappointed, because I would have in a heartbeat driven down to Seattle to watch Montreal play in person. Very easily done, but of course the schedule makers gave us Vancouver TFC and then Seattle Montreal. Like, man, you couldn't have staggered it a different week, you know, put the Whitecaps on the road, Seattle at home, just a chance to go check out Montreal. Yeah, it's on a good day. It's a 3-hour drive. So that's my biggest disappointment. But hey, for Montreal, though, I'm sure it'll be a big game for them because what's the last one of their marathon road trip? I think it's game number 6, right? And then they head home to Saputo. So that's probably going to give them a bit of a morale boost to just know that the line is near. And look, they can finish it off with the win. I think if they do, they put themselves in a very good position for what's going to be a home-heavy schedule for the next little while, which could really allow them to build confidence, move up the table, and really start playing Laurent Courtois ball. Because that's the thing. You ask anyone in Montreal and you see it, it feels like they're maybe at 30, 40, 50% of what they want out of Courtois ball. They're very organized defensively. They're fighting for each other. They play with a knife between their teeth. But possession-wise, their movement, some of the partnerships, they're not there yet. And that's exciting to imagine because we've already seen glimpses of Martinez, like you mentioned, Dominik Yankov, you know, continues to embed in, and some of those other names. There's a lot more growth to come.
I'm excited to see to go down your road. This is, I think, how you guys get excited. You're like, ooh, the game's going to change a little bit on turf. That's actually what I'm looking forward to at Lumen Field. Like, will they be able to dial that up? Will they have to dial it back? Will they find that the turf, you know, runs in a way that's not complementary to Courtois ball? But yeah, it'll be exciting. The football gods at least gave us, and football gods, the television makers, however you want to say it, at least gave us, you know, the gift that you've got. I didn't say that football gods are television makers. I was differentiating between the two, and Ben with a big laugh. Trust me, the television makers can be the devil. I speak from experience. The Canada-Brazil She Believes Cup semifinal is a 3:30 kickoff. So you've got back-to-back-to-back games worth watching on Saturday.
That one's going to be tight, though. She Believes 3:30. Whitecaps kicks off at 4:30. It's going to be make for some...
No, 3:30. It's 3:30 Eastern time.
Oh, it is? Okay, good. Because I had it in 3:30 in my schedule. So it's good to know that it's Eastern. In that case, I'm not mad, and I am a lot happier than I was 10 seconds ago.
Every now and then, boys, I can put a smile on your face. Every now and then. This is the point where I bid you adieu, though. My time is up, friends, so do put a bow on this program however you feel necessary. You're professionals, and I miss you guys. I'll talk to you soon.
And we'll jump into your Canucks Abroad roundup as well and the mailbag, proudly presented by our friends over at Canucks-Abroad. Make sure to check out them on their website and platforms. A great service tracking every Canadian playing professionally around the world. And we'll jump into the women first. Arsenal lifted some silverware this weekend as they defeated Chelsea 1-0 in the Conti Cup final, and certainly positive there as Chloe Lacasse went 72 for Arsenal, while Sabrina D'Angelo was an unused sub in the winning effort. On Chelsea's side, Kadisha Buchanan started and went 120 minutes in the loss, while Ashley Lawrence was an unused substitute for the Blues. And to the WSL, Adrienne Leon went 90 and scored in Aston Villa's 2-2 draw with Leicester City as she remains in good form heading into the Canadian camp. Deanne Rose played 83 minutes as a starter for Leicester in that one as well. Shalina Zdorsky went 90 for West Ham in a 0-0 draw with Brighton. And Vanessa Gilles had 45 minutes off the bench for Leon in a 3-0 win over Le Havre. Alexandria Lamontagne went 90 and scored in Saint-Étienne's 4-3 win over Guingamp. And Julia Grasso went 90 and scored the winner for Juventus in a 4-0 drubbing of Fiorentina. Evelyn Vienne played 65 minutes in a 2-1 win over Inter Milan as well. And in a battle of Canadians, Mary Yasmin Alidou and Chandra Davidson each went 77 for Benfica, while Olivia Smith went 70 for Sporting as Benfica defeated Sporting 1-0 in the first leg of their Taça de Portugal semifinals. Clarissa Larissi went 26 minutes for BK Hacken as they were eliminated by PSG in the Champions League quarterfinals. Then she entered in the 68th minute for Hacken in their Svenska Cupen semifinal matchup against Hammarby, helping them advance to the final on penalties. So chances at silverware there for Clarissa Larissi. Kaylin Sheridan went the full 90 and kept the clean sheet as the San Diego Wave defeated the Seattle Reign 1-0. And Jordan Heidema went 90 minutes for the Reign in that one, while Quinn missed out with their concussion. Janine Becky went 64 and Jesse Fleming had 77 for the Portland Thorns, while Christine Sinclair had 13 minutes off the bench as Portland drew 2-2 with Louisville. And Amanda Allen played 1 minute off the bench in a 1-1 draw for the Orlando Pride against the Chicago Red Stars. Desiree Scott returned as well, 1 minute for KC in their 4-2 win over Angel City. That's her first appearance since 2022. And Bianca St. George played 73 minutes, well as Victoria Pickett playing 63 minutes as starters for the North Carolina Courage in a 1-0 win over Gotham. Sophie Schmidt went 90 for the Houston Dash, while Amanda West went 80 as the Dash beat Bay FC 3-2 in a wild game. Meanwhile, Lissian Prue went 90 for Bay FC in that loss. Gabby Carl went 90 for the Washington Spirit in a 2-1 win over the Utah Royals as well. And that's all we've got for this episode of the Northern Football Podcast. A big check-in on our women's national team players abroad ahead of the She Believes Cup. Certainly a lot in good form and a lot to look forward to this weekend with the Canadian clash in MLS as well. And of course, the exciting news coming from Project 8. But for Brendan in Toronto, Alex in Vancouver, and myself in Jonathan David's birth town of Brooklyn, thanks so much for tuning into NFP, and we'll be back next week.